that lines. Iran's president says his country will hold talks with the U.S. within the framework of the 2015 nuclear deal once Washington ends its economic terrorism on Tehran. Italy calls on the United Nations to launch a probe into the killing of its ambassador in an ambush in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And authorities in the U.S. state of Texas say around 3.4 million people still face disrupted water supplies following a deadly winter storm last week. Our top story for this half hour, Iran's president says that Tehran will sit down for talks within the framework of the 2015 nuclear deal only if the new U.S. administration lifts the economic sanctions imposed by its predecessor.
The new U.S. administration should immediately stop economic terrorism operations against Iran. Such a move will open the way. That's the key to opening the door and holding talks together. We have no problems with that.
Rouhani added President Joe Biden's administration has acknowledged that the anti-Iran maximum pressure campaign by Donald Trump has failed. So Rouhani added the new U.S. Government should abandon that policy. He then underlined it was Iran that preserved the nuclear deal despite scaling down its commitments in response to Washington's 2018 illegal withdrawal from the accord. The Iranian president said his country has been the only signatory to the deal to fully deliver on all of its commitments. He called on the Europeans and the U.S. to make good on their commitments too. Well, the three European signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal have called on Tehran to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency. In a joint statement, foreign ministers of Britain, France, and Germany expressed regret about Iran's decision to suspend the additional protocol to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. In the meantime, the U.S. State Department spokesman called on Iran to work with the UN nuclear body. The comments come despite a deal reached between Tehran and the IAEA, which temporarily extends inspections of Iran's nuclear sites for 3 months. Iran's parliament passed a law last December which required the government to take further steps to scale back Iran's commitments under the JCPOA, including halting the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol. The parliament's decision was in response to the remaining signatories' failure to keep their end of the bargain. Political commentator Mostafa Khoshchehm says Iran's decision to suspend the implementation of the additional protocol has its roots in the failure of the new U.S. administration to lift sanctions.
So, for quite a long time, they've been misusing Iran's loyalty and optimism with regard to conflict resolution. But after the U.S. exited the deal, and the Europeans didn't comply with the terms of their undertakings under the JCPOA, even 14 months after the JCPOA was left by the United States, Iran started modifying its undertakings to send a signal that it would not stay under the deal for quite a long time. But at around September, Iran halted its modifications in order to give a final chance, a last chance, to the Biden administration if he wins the election, and he won the election. Now, 1 month later, after he came to office, he still denies what he needs to do, what's right, removing the sanctions. So, as they persist in the same containment strategy, Iran has resumed, again, its modification of its undertakings. The remaining part was the surveillance and inspections under the additional protocol to the NPT, which has happened to be the most vital part. Iran was never willing to stop it, but it was forced by the U.S. persistent and continued sanctions policy against Iran.
Also, Iran's parliament has set up a commission to resolve differences with the government over a recent agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency. The deal allows the IAEA to carry out short-notice inspections of the country's nuclear facilities. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Iran's parliament speaker, Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, has announced that the parliament will set up a dispute resolution commission to interact with the government and resolve disputes. over a recent agreement between the government and the International Atomic Energy Agency. This came a day after leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, demanded that the parliament and government resolve their differences through cooperation. On Sunday, the government reached a deal with the IAEA to allow the agency to continue its monitoring of Iranian nuclear sites for up to 3 months. This came despite a law passed by parliament last December that tasked the government of President Hassan Rouhani to stop the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol, which gives broad authorities to IAEA inspectors, as of February 23rd. The Dispute Resolution Commission also seeks to ensure that the government will not violate this law.
When we pass a bill, the bill becomes law and the government must implement it. The law stipulates that any inspection beyond the NPT framework must stop as of February 23rd. But the government unilaterally reached a deal with the IAEA that allows the U.S. to buy time.
The agreement came after IAEA's chief Rafael Grossi made an urgent trip to Iran, where the two sides agreed that Iran would unilaterally record the monitoring data, but would share it with the IAEA only if all United States sanctions are lifted. Otherwise, all the data will be destroyed after 3 months. Iran's foreign ministry says the talks resulted in a very significant diplomatic achievement, which does not violate the parliament's law.
The law came into force today and we have executed it. The IAEA cameras will no longer send weekly images from our nuclear sites. We will keep the images and after 3 months, we will show them to the IAEA on the conditions that the U.S. lift all the sanctions. We made this agreement with Mr. Grossi and it is not against the law passed by the parliament.
But lawmakers hold a different view, calling the agreement illegal.
Only our cameras should operate during the next 3 months. The law that we approved seeks to end the other side's dilly-dallying. We wanted to put a final word on it and tell the US and the EU to live up to their commitments, or we will suspend the additional protocol. But Rouhani's wrong policy torpedoed our efforts.
All this struggle began in 2018, when former U.S. president unilaterally left the nuclear deal and reinstated sanctions against Tehran. In response, Iran began a stepwise suspension of its nuclear obligations, the last of which is the February 23rd suspension of IAEA's short-notice inspections. Joe Biden now seems to be willing to return to the pact, but he has been urging Iran to act first and return to its obligations.
The stalemate over the JCPOA seems to have spilled into Iran's domestic politics. The government views the IAEA deal as the last shot in bringing the U.S. to the negotiating table. While lawmakers say they will not be satisfied with anything less than full implementation of the law they passed. They say talks with the West have already proved futile. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Italy has called on the United Nations to probe the recent killing of its ambassador to the Democratic Republic of Congo. Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio says Rome wants the World Food Program and the UN to clarify what happened. He said the Italian government expects a prompt, clear, and exhaustive response. Italian envoy Luca Attanasio died in a Monday ambush in a dangerous part of the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo near the border with Rwanda. The ambush targeted a World Food Program convoy. The DRC has blamed a Rwandan insurgent group for the killing. The group has pointed the finger at Rwandan and Congolese armies. Officials in France have called for a ban on public gatherings and partial weekend lockdowns as the number of countries' COVID-19 intensive care patients rose to a 12-week high of over 3,400. Regional authorities called for the restrictions as Paris continues to resist a new national lockdown to control more contagious variants of the coronavirus. The country has recorded over 20,000 new infections and 431 deaths. The figures raise the total cases to more than 3.6 million and the death toll to over 85,000. Elsewhere in Europe, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said her country is now in a third wave of the coronavirus pandemic. Merkel also noted that the slow vaccination rollout and the risk of major outbreaks of fast-spreading variants have made any easing of restrictions introduced late last year more difficult. Authorities in the U.S. state of Texas say around 3.4 million people still face disrupted water supplies following a deadly winter storm last week. The authorities said over 200 counties were reporting water issues as of Tuesday evening. The number was much lower compared to Monday, when over 7.9 million people faced water disruptions. The freezing weather conditions left dozens dead and knocked out power stations in Texas. It took several days for the authorities to restore power. Fresh water and food have been distributed to residents, with long queues formed in some locations to receive the supplies. New York's Attorney General says the police officers involved in the last year killing of unarmed African-American Daniel Prude will not be indicted. Letitia James said the officers will face no criminal charges following a decision by a grand jury. She criticized the U.S. criminal justice system for allowing police to use force unnecessarily and without facing consequences. The New York Attorney General said the system is broken at its core and needs reforms. A video of Prude's march arrest by Rochester police was made public in September. The footage showed an officer putting a spit hood over his head, holding it tightly. Prude died days later. The video gave a boost to anti-racism rallies in the U.S. U.S. President Joe Biden is expected to call Saudi Arabia's King Salman, as an American intelligence report on the murder of prominent journalist Jamal Khashoggi is about to come out. The Wednesday call would be the first talk between Biden as U.S. president and King Salman. A U.S. media outlet said Khashoggi's case would be a hot topic of their conversation. According to Axios, the report by the U.S. Director of National Intelligence could put one of the king's sons in a difficult situation. The unclassified document reportedly implies that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was involved in Khashoggi's murder. Khashoggi was a Washington Post columnist and strong critic of Saudi government policies. He was assassinated by Saudi agents at the country's consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. President of Venezuela Nicolas Maduro has accused the U.S. and its allies of deepening the economic crisis in the South American country by imposing illegal sanctions. Legal experts say such sanctions amount to crimes against innocent people. From Caracas, our correspondent Jesus Silva has more on this report.
Delivering a speech at the 46th session of the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro denounced the damaging effects of ongoing illegal sanctions by the U.S. and its allies against the Bolivarian Republic. Maduro outlined that Washington, following its regime change policy, leads a coalition of states that the European Union is part of, which is implementing a long series of punishing measures to deliberately bring about a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela and overthrow his administration. Maduro mentioned details of these measures.
Through illegal measures, Venezuela has been deprived of $30 billion in cash, which are part of the assets of the Republic abroad.
In this light, the socialist president strongly condemned the U.S. government and its allies over their abusive actions against the Venezuelan people.
Those who have taken away Venezuelan assets and resources have shown their cruelty, even worse at a time of a pandemic.
Although some opposition figures in Venezuela argue that the U.S. sanctions are a needed political tool to force anticipated elections in the Latin American country, legal analysts say that such sanctions are totally illegal and unacceptable.
What the U.S. is doing to our nation violates international law and all human rights instruments. There is no way to justify such a crime.
President Maduro denounced over 450 illegal sanctions U.S. and its allies imposed on Venezuela. Maduro pointed out that despite the massive economic aggression, his socialist government will not be overthrown. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
Clashes have erupted in the Bolivian capital, La Paz, between police and medics during a protest against a new health emergency law. Riot police fired tear gas to scatter protesters who demanded the repeal of the controversial legislation. Health workers have been on strike across Bolivia since Friday to show their opposition. The law bans medical staff from taking job action during the coronavirus pandemic. It also allows the hiring of foreign doctors and nurses. The protesters say the move is unconstitutional and restricts the right to protest. The COVID-19 outbreak has pushed many hospitals in Bolivia to the brink of collapse. The Andean country has so far reported nearly 250,000 infections and more than 11,000 deaths. Crowds of Ecuadorian indigenous people have arrived in the capital, Quito, to protest an alleged electoral fraud. Protesters demanded a recount of this month's presidential election. Left-wing indigenous leader Yaku Perez addressed them. He said of the nearly 40,000 voting sheets, almost half have inconsistencies. Perez said that has denied him a place in the runoff. Ecuador's elections council this week confirmed that left-wing economist Andres Arauz and conservative banker Guillermo Lasso will advance to the runoff. The vote is slated for April 11th. Protesters have once again taken to the streets in Myanmar to denounce a military coup that ousted the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. Hundreds gathered in Mandalay and the largest city, Yangon, chanting slogans against the military. The protests have continued unabated for more than 2 weeks now, in defiance of an enhanced security measures of by the military. A civil disobedience campaign has continued as well. People want civilian leaders to be reinstated and detained officials to be released. Myanmar's army seized power on February the 1st. It alleged fraud in the November elections in which Suu Kyi's party won against a pro-military party. So far, three protesters have been killed and hundreds have been arrested. Nesan Lewin, the coordinator of the Free Rohingya Coalition, says a major goal of the protesters in Myanmar is to change the current constitution that gives power to the military.
The protests are increasing day by day, and across the country, millions of people are taken to the street and they are protesting against this military coup. They don't want this military dictatorship at all. And also, most of them agree to demand to abolish the 2008 constitution, which was created by this military regime in 2008. Now the trend is they are targeting to abolish this constitution, which will enable the equal rights, justice for all, because this constitution is controlling by the military, and they are sharing the 25% seats at the parliament and also the some ministry. The minister needs to be appointed by the commander in chief, and they are from the military. So I think the movement they call the Myanmar Early Spring Revolution, this will be, if they go continuously like now, I think the military will not last this time.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
الله اکبر
all of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
The issue of treacherous and malicious sanctions. Those days, the 19th of day, we were not well equipped, but today we are equipped with the intellectual, practical, political, and thankfully military weapons. We have also overcome many obstacles, and the goal is to establish a new Islamic civilization. This is our ultimate goal. It is possible that one generation may not achieve this, but the path will continue by Allah's favor. Future generations will attain this goal. We should overcome imperialist transgressions and vicious policies that they formulate against our country. Our positions against the US government originate from this outlook, this argument, and this philosophy. These points were about the 19th of day. As for the current affairs of the country, one of the most repeated issues in the challenge between the Islamic Republic and the Front of Arrogance headed by the US is the issue of sanctions. Another issue is Iran's regional presence. Yet, another is Iran's defensive and missile power.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
They constantly say something and nag about it, and this side too says something in response. Of course, our officials have responded to the Front of Arrogance on all three issues, our military officials, our Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and our people, with their slogans have responded to them. But now, I wish to say the final and definite word in this regard. As for the sanctions, the Western Front and our enemies are obliged to stop the malicious move, imposing sanctions against the Iranian nation immediately. It is their responsibility to lift all sanctions. This is a treacherous and malicious move, and it is grave and unreasonable enmity against the Iranian nation. They are showing enmity not only towards the Islamic government or the administration, but also against the Iranian people. It is their responsibility to lift these sanctions immediately.
Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
another controversy for the private U.S. security firm Blackwater. A confidential UN report says Eric Prince, the company's founder and former head, has violated an arms embargo on Libya by sending mercenaries and weapons to support Libyan renegade general Khalifa Haftar. The report, obtained by the New York Times, details how Mr. Prince, a close ally of former U.S. President Donald Trump, deployed heavily armed foreign troops to eastern Libya to assist Khalifa Haftar in the heat of an attack to capture Tripoli in 2019. According to the UN, the $80 million operation included plans for the mercenaries to assassinate selected Libyan commanders. The report raises questions about possible ties between the operation and the Trump administration. Prince did not cooperate with the UN investigation and has rejected having anything to do with the military operations in Libya. However, the report exposes him to possible UN sanctions.
Well, it's all the same thing, that it broke the law and that he was told to do it. I mean, it doesn't really make much of a difference. In fact, the laws, or international law and laws, are meaningless to the United States. And in 2011, when the U.S. led the NATO bombing to destroy the Libyan government and the government there, and for regime change, that was against international law, but it didn't mean it. So they break international law all the time. When they level sanctions against countries, these are violations of international law. And so, you know, that's, it's par for the course. It's very telling, though, that they are, that they would be doing this use of mercenaries.
Since 2014, two rival seats of power have emerged in Libya, namely the internationally recognized government of Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj and another group based in the eastern city of Tobruk, supported militarily by Haftar's troops. The damning 120-page UN report on Blackwater's contract in Libya was another instance of military intervention by Washington-linked private security companies in the internal affairs of countries around the world. In recent years, there has been a surge in the activity of guns for hire in countries like Yemen, Nigeria, Ukraine, Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Some of the mercenaries have capabilities and equipment on par with elite U.S. troops. But Blackwater is not the only such American firm that is active in conducting high-level overseas operations. Back in May, Venezuela arrested 13 individuals charged with planning an operation in the capital, Caracas, two of whom were American nationals. The U.S. mercenaries admitted that they were arrested during a failed attempt to raid Venezuela's presidential palace and seize President Nicolas Maduro.
We had a casual conversation, I guess you'd call it a verbal contract, giving me some vague mission guidelines on training Venezuelans coming here and putting Maduro on a plane.
The two said they had been working with Jordan Goodrow, an American military veteran who leads a Florida-based security company called Silvercorp USA.
The measures that the United States will take for regime change to advance their interests, very obscene, immoral measures, are revealed all the time. What the reason why they like to use mercenaries in a lot of these things and what they do, and then the academy or this group that used to be Blackwater, got its notoriety for doing things that gave the United States plausible denial.
The involvement of the U.S.-backed troops in these countries wasn't the first, and certainly won't be the last. But does the growing number of operations indicate that the U.S. is opting for a more indirect means of intervening in other nations' affairs?
Recently published satellite images by the International Panel on Fissile Material have revealed that Israel is expanding its Dimona nuclear facility in the Negev Desert. Israel has acknowledged the existence of the Dimona nuclear reactor, however, it neither confirms nor denies the purpose of the facility. The site has provided the Israeli regime with the material needed for its nuclear arsenal, according to a report by a non-profit organization named Federation of American Scientists. In 2020, Israel possesses close to 100 atomic nuclear warheads that are made from plutonium produced in a Dimona heavy water reactor. However, other sources have put that figure at 300, with some estimates even going as far as 400 nuclear warheads. The Israeli regime has a deliberate ambiguity policy on its nuclear arsenal, which means despite being the only possessor of nuclear weapons in West Asia, it always refuses to accept or deny having any. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls on nuclear transparency, and it has never allowed any inspections of its nuclear facilities. With the US's invariable support, the regime has so far defied the international calls to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT. The treaty aims to halt the spread of nuclear arms and weapons technology. This is all while Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program and assassinated several nuclear scientists in recent years. However, Iran has rejected all these accusations, as it was among the first nations to sign the NPT. In January, Iran's permanent representative to Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, denounced favoritism towards Israel by the International Atomic Agency. He said such a treatment has given the Israeli regime the audacity to ridicule the watchdog and press ahead with its advancing nuclear weapons program in defiance of international calls. Israel's possession of nuclear warhead poses a significant threat to regional stability. The regime has carried out bombing campaigns against Syria for the past years. It's threatened Iran militarily on numerous occasions. And when it comes to Hezbollah, Israel has repeatedly threatened to destroy the resistance group.
First of all, they want to keep it as secret as possible, but there's another reason for this, and it's because Israel gets a large amount of economic and military aid from the United States. It's the biggest recipient of U.S. aid. And there is a bill that was passed, I guess, 60 years ago, the Symington Amendment, which said that we cannot provide aid to any nation that has a nuclear weapon and is not part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Israel's name has been synonymous with aggression, illegal occupation, and war with regional countries, as well as other international crimes. In August 2018, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu threatened Iran with atomic annihilation, right from the regime's Dimona atomic weapons facility. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif slammed Netanyahu by calling his statement beyond shameless. The regime is the centre of fabrications against Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program, which is subject to round-the-clock monitoring by the UN. Israel has made baseless allegations against Iran, saying it is developing nuclear weapons, yet the regime owns atomic warheads and refrains from allowing inspections of its facilities. Unlike Iran, Israel has so far refused to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, whose aim is to prevent the spread of nuclear arms and weapons technology, in defiance of international pressure. Several countries have helped out Israel to develop its nuclear arsenal. They have secretly sold the Israeli regime material and expertise to build warheads. These nations include the US, France, Germany, Britain, and even Norway.
Well, you can draw the conclusion that perhaps the United States likes volatile regions. The more death and destruction, the better. It survives on this, and it invests extremely heavily in the most powerful military regime on the planet.
However, Israel's nuclear weapons project would never have succeeded without a major contribution from France. Surprisingly, Paris took the toughest line on counter-proliferation when it came to Iran's peaceful nuclear program, whilst at the same time it helped lay the foundations of the Israeli regime's atomic weapons. Whilst Israel has fabricated accusations against Iran's peaceful nuclear program, it's the only possessor of atomic warheads in the West Asia region. There have been growing calls for a region free of nuclear weapons. So why then have the US and Europe themselves turned a deaf ear to such demands?
US President Joe Biden's administration has announced three symbolic gestures toward Iran in an apparent break with former President Donald Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. Ned Price, a spokesman for the State Department, said Thursday the Biden administration was willing to meet with Iranian officials and other world powers involved in negotiating the nuclear deal. Price said Washington would accept an invitation from the European Union's top diplomat to attend a meeting aimed to discuss a diplomatic way forward on Iran's nuclear program.
Well, the U.S. is trying to play a little game here by saying, I'm going to go to Europe and I'm going to meet Iranians and I want to talk about the JCPOA, and maybe the U.S. will lift some sanctions. It's just the message the U.S. is just not getting it right. The U.S. needs to understand when Iran stopped giving false hope that there is no return to the JCPOA unless the Americans lift all sanctions, apply the lifting of the sanctions, allow Iran to sell its oil and to make deal with other companies as stated in JCPOA, and then Iran will stop withdrawing from the nuclear deal.
Washington says it has lifted travel restrictions on Iranian diplomats accredited to the United Nations, headquartered in New York, limitations that were imposed by Trump in 2019. Also, in a letter to the UN Security Council on behalf of Biden, acting U.S. Ambassador Richard Mills said the United States has withdrawn three letters from the Trump administration that claimed the U.S. had reimposed UN sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Mills said that sanctions measures terminated in Resolution 2231 endorsing the nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, with six world powers, remain terminated. This is why the overwhelming majority of the members in the 15-nation council had described Trump's bid to restore UN embargoes on Iran as illegal, arguing the U.S. was no longer a member of the JCPOA. In a tweet, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif responded to the U.S. acknowledgement that the snapback mechanism of the JCPOA has not been triggered. He reiterated Iran's position that Washington must lift all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled under the Trump administration before Tehran reverses its scaleback of the commitments under the nuclear accord. Zarif had earlier urged France, Britain, and Germany, three European signatories to the nuclear agreement, to abandon their calls on Iran to act first to salvage the JCPOA and instead demand an end to the U.S. quote, economic terrorism on Tehran. In a reaction to the U.S. announcement that it would accept the EU's invitation to a meeting of Iran and the P5+1, Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said P5+1 no longer exists due to Washington's withdrawal from the deal. He repeated Iranian official stance that the U.S. must first put its words into action before Tehran follows suit. Even after the U.S. exit from the JCPOA and the reimposition of sanctions, Iran remained fully committed to the accord for a year before gradually reducing its commitments in five steps, citing the failure of the European signatories to the deal to keep their end of the bargain.
Iran made it very clear the government is forced to abide by the decision of the parliament. And the parliament decided to implement several steps, one after the other. The first one is the 21st of February, and on the 21st of February, Iran will withdraw from the voluntary protocol and will reduce the sudden inspection of the atomic energy inspector. Therefore, the Americans need to understand that there are other steps that will follow if the sanctions are not lifted.
The country has times and again noted that all the retaliatory steps are reversible once all signatories honor their obligations.
Myanmar has been the scene of mass demonstrations against junta leaders ever since the February 1 coup. Anti-coup protesters have defied a crackdown by the military, taking to the streets in several cities across the country almost daily. Demonstrators are demanding the release of the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, who was detained along with a number of parliament members. They're also demanding the restoration of civilian rule. Myanmar's junta has ratcheted up security measures to quell anti-coup demonstrations, and the internet in Yangon has been down for several days. Junta leaders deny they staged a coup and justified their power seizure by alleging widespread voter fraud in November elections that Suu Kyi's party won. They also pledged to hold new elections soon. This, however, has failed to calm down the situation.
I guess a lot of times
with the Burma army and the Burmese dictators. They are always above the law. So why he doesn't calm the situation is because he doesn't want to calm the situation, because he wants things to be under his control, and he wanted to hold on to the power the way he wants to run the country. And that is why, although you will see a lot of chaotic going on, and you would think that if he's talking about the election issues and election is fraud, if that is the case, then why violence?
The army generals have filed multiple charges against the deposed leader, including ignoring an import and export law over walkie-talkies that were found in her home during a search. The Nobel laureate's lawyer says she has also been hit with a second charge, which is violating the country's disaster management law. Observers believe the accusations against Suu Kyi are an indication that the military is seeking a permanent grip on power.
Nobody knows how long the military is going to hold on to the power, but it is very worrisome that they probably may not want to let go the power, because for so many reasons, especially those who are in power, like high-ranking position like Mae Aung Lee, he has so much political ambition in order to become the president, and even more so in order to control and have control over his own economic ambitions.
The military seizure of power has drawn global reactions. The United Nations has warned the army of several consequences of any harsh response to protesters. The UN Special Rapporteur said Myanmar's generals will be held accountable for any suppression of the civil disobedience campaign there. The coup also drew reactions from other international players. China said the situation in Myanmar is not what Beijing wants to see. It also rejected social media rumors that China was involved in the coup as complete nonsense. However, China, along with Russia, says the coup is Myanmar's internal affairs. The United States, however, has taken a different stance. Last Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden announced new sanctions on those responsible for the coup and any entities linked to junta leaders. Biden said Washington will be ready to impose additional measures. There is also the risk of a new confrontation between U.S. and China, maybe over Myanmar.
I mean, look, yes, the U.S. is talking about threatening to impose sanctions, targeted sanctions especially. And what did they do in the past week? They did impose some targeted sanctions, but it's just on what, on the gems companies. But the most important thing to follow, to go behind, is the oil and gas company that is owned by the military. That is where they make a whole bunch of money in order to buy their submarines, their warplanes, all kinds of sophisticated weapons, which we call Mag and Mel, the oil company. They didn't do anything about it. That is something we wanted to see the U.S. will sanction.
The two nuclear-armed countries are already facing off on a range of other issues, including the U.S. interference in China's periphery, such as the South China Sea and the Korean Peninsula, as well as the trade and cyber wars between them. Myanmar is just another geopolitical war threat for China and the U.S., but observers believe Beijing has an edge over Washington in this struggle.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام وسئل عليه السلام عن الإيمان فقال الإيمان معرفة بالقلب وإقرار باللسان وعمل بالأركان.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam was asked about belief when he said, "Belief means appreciation with the heart, acknowledgement with the tongue, and action with the limbs."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So one of the great lessons and profound lessons and really beautiful lessons which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is this concept of taqwa, this idea of piety
or as is known in a little bit of a different way, as the consciousness of Allah or the awareness of Allah that a person has. Now, Ammar bin Yasir, the very famous companion of the Holy Prophet, and likewise a very famous companion of Imam Ali alayhi salam, has reported that the Holy Prophet said that Imam Ali had the peak, in my own words, had the peak of piety. Now, piety, dear friends, according to this tradition of the Holy Prophet, has three stages. One, and so the Holy Prophet Muhammad here is talking to Imam Ali alayhi salam, and he says that this divine ornament has three stages, which are all rooted in you, O Ali. Allah detached you from the world, made the world look disgusting to you, and Allah placed the love for the poor in your heart, O Ali, to the extent that the poor are pleased with your leadership, and you, Ali, are pleased to be followed by them. Happy is one who has the love for you, O Ali, and he is steadfast in following you and practically approves your instructions. And woe is to your enemy and one who denies you. As for your friends and followers, they are your brothers in faith, and they will abide in paradise with you. And as for your enemies and those who have denied you, Allah Almighty should place them in the abode of liars. We find, dear friends, that piety isn't something as simple as we think, even though it is simple and all of us can acquire a certain level of piety to the best of our ability. But the peaks of piety, the summit of piety, of course, which is manifested in the universal persona of Imam Ali, is something that is unimaginable and perhaps for people like me, unattainable. The divine ornaments of piety, three stages which Allah has allotted, all of them in the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Brother Hassanain Rajabali.
When Allah says, Allah bidhikri Allahi tatma'innu al-qulub, dhikri Allah is this. When you remember Ahlul Bayt, when you remember the Messenger, when you remember Allah, you find that your heart wants to get closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You find that Imam Ali alayhi salam was hated, loved and hated. Shaheed Mutahhari has written an excellent book. He says, polarization around the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. He's a character that brought people towards him, and he's a man who repulsed people. There were two sides to him. In other words, two sides in the sense that of people. One hated him passionately, and one loved him to the point of giving anything. They could give their whole lives to him. You find the lovers of Ahlul Bayt today, the lovers of Amir al-Mu'mineen today, are proving themselves. Today, they are the best resistors of any form of oppression. They have meager armaments. They are neighbors of vicious people. Yet they defend the truth. They are fighters. They defend justice. They don't allow injustice. They don't allow oppression. They don't allow their lands to be occupied. They don't allow themselves to be made slaves. They don't allow themselves to be fooled. Why? Because Imam Ali alayhi salam has taught us that if you follow my way, as Allah says, that if you follow this one, then you are of that successful one. You are the one who is the winner. This is a clear command. Imam Ali alayhi salam's character, briefly. And what a gift of Allah that Allah has planted this love of Ahlul Bayt in their hearts. And I'm telling you, it's there. Because humans love the best examples. Imam Ali alayhi salam is that kind of an example where he never made a person feel bad. His wisdom was beyond comprehension. When he would answer complex mathematical answers, people were stunned. Even the second caliph, he says, how come you answer so quickly? He's asking the second caliph, what is one? How many are these? He says, two. Imam says, how come you don't waste time in answering this? He says, that's how I see. When you ask me such question, when he says, saluni, saluni, qabla an tafqiduni, ask me, before you miss me. Why did he say that? Because he has already been endowed with this wisdom. He has been endowed with this knowledge for you and I to follow. But he's just not a man of wisdom. He's a man of action.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.